We'd like you to watch our program each week on this station. It's called The Champions. By the way, my name is Stuart Damon.
Stuart plays Craig Sterling, one of the champions. I'm Alexandra Bastido, and I play Sharon McCready.
William Gaunt, I play Richard Barrett. Well, we're the champions. It's new, it's intriguing. Be sure to watch. You'll find it exciting.
Hello and welcome to another episode of ITC Entertain the World, the podcast. And as always, I'm joined by my fabulous co-hosts, Al Smudge and Rodney Marshall. I'll just say hello to those. Hello, guys. How are you doing?
Evening, Jazz.
Yeah, hi, Jazz. All good. Thank you.
Today, we are going to talk about the series The Champions, which began production in about February 67, starred Stuart Damon as Craig Sterling, Alexandra Bastido as Sharon McCready, William Gaunt as Richard Barrett, and Anthony Nichols as their boss, Tremaine. They were based in Geneva, working for an agency called Nemesis. There were 30 episodes made. It was made in colour. It was produced by Monty Berman and created by Dennis Spooner. It's quite an interesting ITC series because it's the first that uses the three lead, multiple lead format. Prior to this, we'd had things like Danger Man, we'd had The Saint, Man of the World, which arguably are sort of single lead characters. We had a bit of progression with the Baron because obviously we had his sidekick Cordelia and Sue Lloyd, but this is the first series where we have three leading stars, obviously one of them being American for the all-important American network sale that Lou Grade was always after with his ITC shows. Don't know if you guys want to add anything there.
Not only perhaps, obviously with Stuart Damon, as was the case with Richard Bradford before, he's not going to be a name to sell into the States, is he?
He's just an American that they can say we've cast an American in the lead.
Yeah, it's just a point of identification for their viewers, really.
So the series began production after the end of The Baron. I believe Dennis Spooner had been very keen on a character called The Amazing Wilson, which was a comic book character in the DC Thompson comics. And I think he was trying originally to base his series around that character. And I don't know much about this comic book character, but obviously, DC Thompson said you can't use that character because it was still in the comic books. But there are sort of echoes of Wilson's abilities in The Champions. Basically, if we think about it, The Champions is kind of almost like a superhero format, isn't it? Where they're given superpowers. And with these superpowers, they are able to conduct and obviously complete the cases that they're involved with. One thing that I would say about this series in the setup and writing about it, unlike, say, Department S, where the sort of stories are fantastical, these are sort of much more straightforward and down-to-earth stories. Would you agree with that?
There's a good, solid grounding to the stories. You can clearly see a period awareness coming through. You've got the submarine threat. Everybody thought back in the 60s, in the time of the Cold War, there were these Russian submarines lurking off the coast of England, waiting to blow us all up. The Champions is very, very much a nuclear age series because you've got illicit bomb testing. You've got our bomb testing. At the same point as how it's looking forward into the nuclear age, it also looks back 20-odd years into the Second World War. So you've got a fairly reasonable grounding if some of the stories are a little fantastical.
once you're over the idea that these three have got superpowers, it's actually a reasonably realistic spy thriller. The fantasy is almost in that concept, and beyond that, the actual storylines are quite 60s Cold War.
Yeah, it's far more up-to-date thematically with the nuclear stuff and all that.
Yeah, I think when I was describing it to you guys in my notes, I said it really is like the Cold War ITC series, like you said about those nuclear submarines in particular, that we'll come on to with those sets of those, but also that looking back to, like you say, the end of the Second World War. And the fantasy elements of it, I don't really think they were particularly pushed. It's less fantasy based than I think a lot of people remember. I think lots of people have sort of, because of the superpowers, for it is much more sort of fantastical, if you know what I mean.
Coming back to it, you realise that what you sort of forget is it's as much about the three central character development. We, like them, are learning each week the extent of their superpowers. We see different things, they realise different things.
In a way, that aspect, which I think is one of the great aspects of the show, it does remind me a little bit of Marty Hopkirk. In that one of the joys of that show is, as we discover, and indeed Marty does, what he can and can't do as a ghost. And in a not dissimilar way here, they're learning all the time. Oh, actually, I can hold my breath underwater, or I can hear that person from a couple of miles away. And I think that's rather nice. They're learning as we are.
Yeah, because they make a point of that in a couple of episodes, don't they? They sort of say, we don't really know what our powers are yet. And as the sort of stories develop, that's when they find out and we find out exactly what they can do.
I think there is a line in the publicity brochure which says the champions are vulnerable because they can never know just how far they can go without exceeding the limits of their human ability.
So as we were saying, it went into production in February 67 to be made in colour. There was some screen tests done and some artists tested, but ultimately we ended up with the three actors we have, like say Stuart Damon, Alexandra Bastido and William Gaunt. And if you have the network DVD set, you can see that there is one of those screen tests on that DVD set. Well, I think there's two actually, come to think of it. Stuart Damon had been appearing in the West End in Houdini, and Monty wanted him and they battled to get him. And I believe the producer at the time took some money from Stuart Damon's fee and then literally closed the production down a week after, but was allowed to keep the fee for the duration of the filming. So he did all right there. Thank you very much. Alexandra Bastido, I believe, was cast after Cyril Frankel had seen her in an advert and was struck by how beautiful she was, according to various sources. William Gaunt was well known because of Sergeant Cork, and he was the more sort of straightforward of the three, especially compared to Stuart Damon, who was like the sort of muscle of the three.
I think of all these late 60s sort of triumvirates, for me, this is the one that works best by a long way, partly because in Department S, it's a great trio, but when Peter Wingard is present, Peter Wingard is always going to dominate. And to a certain extent, with Strange Report, Anthony Quayle, when you've got someone of his caliber, he's also going to be the lead of the co-leads, as it were. But I honestly think here that I never get any impression that there's one dominating, and there's a really good rapport between the three characters. And clearly, when you see them interviewed, there was a great rapport off screen, wasn't there?
Coming back to it, because I've not really watched it for a good long while, you forget how much Sharon actually gets to do in this series. Because when we were talking about Department S, I was saying Rosemary Nichols gets a lot to do, but I think Sharon probably has an equal measure. And a lot of the time in the episodes, she's the glue that sticks it together. There's an element, character-wise, which we only realise virtually at the end. Well, we probably do see it, but we don't sort of get it acknowledged until Autokill. There's this character thing between the boys. They're going together, they're trying to be top dog. But so many times, the Sharon McCready character is the one who makes the links or who motivates them.
Was there any sort of writer's Bible?
I have never seen a writer's Bible, but that's not to say there wasn't one. It's quite interesting there where you bring up that thing about the writers, because obviously, and you mentioned Sharon there, Smudge, because in Tony Williamson, the writer, he made Sharon the sort of central point of his episodes that he wrote. He wrote The Experiment, which is predominantly a Sharon episode. He wrote Shadow of the Panther, again, a predominantly Sharon episode. He was kind of using her as the main protagonist, really, of the three. So that's quite interesting that certain writers picked her out and thought, right, I'm going to center this story around her. In terms of a Bible, no, I've never come across anyone who has it.
The reason I ask is simply that there isn't a huge amount of connective tissue, in the sense that in some episodes, Richard Barrett calls Sharon MacReady. And I quite like that, just calling her by her surname. It's almost like, you're one of us, you're one of the mates. Mm-hmm. And other times she's Sharon. And I would have thought that sort of thing would have been ironed out at the beginning. Look, the boys are going to call Sharon MacReady.
In one of the screen tests, Sharon calls Richard Dick, doesn't she? It doesn't strike me as having a hard and fast set of rules for the writers, apart from the fundamental characters, I suspect. As with many of these series, the characters suffer the convenience or inconvenience of the scripts. Some days they can be 1,000 miles away and the psychic link works perfectly. Other scripts, they can be 30 feet away and they can't hear each other. So there's no connective tissue, there's no glue.
Yeah, I think in The Gunrunners as well, Stuart Damon, doesn't he call her darling or beautiful or something like that?
And in the one where she's just about to open the safe, Richard says, don't go near the safe, love. I mean, they can be quite patronizing towards her, unfortunately.
My name is Stuart Damon. I play Craig Sterling in a new series called The Champions. You'll be seeing it on this channel in the near future. I think you'll find it a very different and exciting hour of entertainment. See you soon on this channel.
If we look at those characters, I mean, like I say, Stuart Damon is kind of the muscle man of the three, isn't he? He's the one who's predominantly more involved in the fights. Whereas Richard Barrett tends to be the sort of the one who uses his brains a little bit more and sort of thinks about a logical approach before sort of bashing the door down. And Sharon, she doesn't really get that involved in too many fights because she was a scientist, it says in the first episode. I think she's given that sort of kind of Rosemary Nichols scientific role, isn't she? Where she can take the ear implant out because she's also a doctor as well, and she can do the heart surgery on the president in one of the submarine episodes.
She can kick ass, and in fact, she kicks Eric Pullman's ass, which is quite a large one, in Autokill.
I think, to an extent, Stuart Damon comes across as a bit of a himbo at times. He's the only one who's pulled out of the crash or repaired from the crash in the beginning with perfect hair. He's a bit of the eye candy-ish at times, I think.
Aren't all three of them, though? I mean, I know one of the comments made by the press at the time was that they almost looked as if they were off an advert. They're so beautiful skin, nice teeth, good-looking, which in a weird way, you see, I think works, because if you take Bastido, for example, her beauty is so remarkable, she's almost unearthly. And I think quite a few people who worked on the show commented on that, that she almost looked as if she was sort of from another race or planet. She had this ethereal quality. And I think that works when you consider they become superhumans, doesn't it?
The finer point of Alexander is when they finally stop faffing around with all the hairspray and the extensions and they just let her have her hair down in one of the episodes. And she looks absolutely stunning.
Well, she looks stunning full stop, no matter what she's kind of wearing, even when she's disheveled, where she turns up in the dark island where she's swam ashore, or she's a bit trampy in the mission where she's that gangster's mole. She just looks incredible all the time.
I'd never seen the series before. And one of the things that struck me with William Gaunt is you can already see he's going to be a good comic actor. He's got a very dry sense of humour. There's an episode, I don't know if we'll cover it later, where he's a cook and he's very, very funny.
Episodes like The Mission and The Iron Man, where they get to go out of their superhero roles undercover, you can really see them enjoying that. And it's good for the actors because they get that variety.
Well, he's also very good as the priest in Full Circle, isn't he? Where, you know, he's got that very thick Irish accent. You know, he's got the bottle of whiskey hidden under his sort of outfit and stuff. I think he takes it less seriously than Stuart Damon does.
That priest is Irish with a capital O. It's a terribly funny accent with the emphasis on terrible.
I watched that documentary where the three of them came back together after many, many years. And I actually found it quite moving. There was a real love there between the three of them.
We shouldn't forget Anthony Nichols as well, is Tremaine, who, as their boss, seems to be constantly befuddled by them. He keeps asking them about, oh, there's a gap in this report or this, that and the other. He does turn nasty in the interrogation. And also in The Fanatics, he gets a bit cross where there's that attempt on his life. I think he's kind of a bit useless as a boss, really.
I think he's sneaky. I mean, you mentioned those two. He lies completely in the experiment. He tells the boys, you know, no, Sharon's off on holiday or whatever. And I think he does that a couple of times.
He's not a fully rounded person. I mean, in at least two episodes, we see that he's basically sleeping on the premises. He eats, breathes, and literally sleeps the organisation. He's there to bring that theatrical gravitas to it. And he has got that, the wig and the beard. It was such a simple arrangement, allegedly took quite some time in makeup, and there were allegedly delays incurred in waiting for Anthony to come on the set.
Is it a weakness of the character, Tremaine, that he doesn't actually cotton on to something very strange going on? I mean, I ask because David Bowers' character in the experiment has clearly worked out that they're superhumans. That's his trap, getting them involved in that.
Is that sort of saying Tremaine's a bit thick?
We're talking about the makeup. I mean, if you look how much Tremaine is in an episode, he must have only been required there one day a week for his scenes. Bearing in mind that these episodes take 10 days to film, you know, he's there sort of at the start to introduce them to the case and tell them what the case is. And he's usually there at the end to sort of get the report when it's all wrapped up. And occasionally he's in the middle of, but he's not in it that much.
This is Department S syndrome again then, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. This is kind of the first series since Danger Man where we get the boss character, isn't it? Because we don't get a boss as such in The Baron. Okay, we get Templeton Green, but he disappears. We don't get a boss in The Saint. We don't get a boss in The Sentimental Agent. So this notion of a boss giving them the case, a bit like M would do to Bond.
William Gaunt said in one of the documentaries, he used to come in once every couple of weeks, effectively film what would be more or less tag scenes, top and tails, as you say.
I'm Alexandra Bastida, and if you watch out on this channel, you'll be able to make a date with me each week as Sharon MacCready in The Champions. It's a new series full of adventure, excitement, and surprise. So watch out and keep that date, won't you? See you soon.
So what do you make of Spooner's premise for it all then?
It's very much influenced from Dennis's love of old movies, as you said, Jazz, because the raid at the beginning, where they're going for the bugs in China, looks very, very similar to the 1960 Margaret Lockwood film, Highly Dangerous. You pointed that out. And when you think about it, yeah, it is very, very striking. So a lot of it has come out of his personal passion for popular culture. You know, you've got the comic book he wanted to do, and then you've got the old Ronald Colman movie. It's interesting to see where he sort of draws his influences from.
I quite like the fact that the fantasy premise leads to something that I found far more grounded than some of the other ITC late 60s shows. There's a line in that publicity brochure, "Our aim is to make incredibility credible." And while it's a bit of a stretch, the fact is, we've had people like John Drake and Simon Templar who probably should have died in a third of the episodes, but they managed to get out of it. And I think here, giving these characters these sort of super qualities, it makes their exploits seem less impossible, I suppose, if that makes any sense.
The fantasy element, I mean, really, when you look at what we're presented with in previous shows, we are literally presented with supermen. The Baron, the Saint particularly, John Drake, they seem to have few, if any, human frailties. And they literally are supermen. And you have to really suspend that disbelief to go with the fact that a person can be this perfect. But here, with this fantastical, supernatural, magical element, Spooner's really nodding, winking at the viewer, saying, yeah, we know all of this is highly incredible. But here's a premise under which you can probably let this all go and just enjoy it.
I think that's a big, big plus. I think that's one of the things that works really, really well.
I have to thank a chap called Mark Rogers, who has been very kind and told me about an interview he did with Dennis Spooner back in 1985. He was at a convention and he met Dennis, and he ended up chatting to him a lot. And the next morning, Dennis joined him at breakfast and they had a long old chat about the Champions in particular. And one of the things that Mark mentions that Dennis had said was that the reason the series had three leads was because Lou Grade was very keen to speed up the production of the one-hour ITC series. The idea behind that being is that you could split the three leads and they could all go off and do parts of the story and be filmed individually as such, and then it could all be edited together. As I was talking to Mark on the email prior to this podcast, that would have involved more crew and more sets and more sound stages. And obviously, when it came to editing, probably more editors because they would have been turning things around quickly. So in terms of cost cutting, it wouldn't have saved any money as such. It's interesting that they didn't go with that in the end. And I know that sometimes the three split into two and two will go off and do something and one will do another part. And there is a bit of that going on. There's episodes where Sharon is on her own and the two men are obviously doing something. Or then it splits. So it's say like Stuart and Sharon or Richard and Sharon. I thought that was quite an interesting thing and a story that I'd not heard before. So I'm really grateful to Mark for sharing that and a number of other bits and pieces that he shared with me in the last few weeks.
It's an interesting concept, but the only way you could really do it and save money would be to uprate your second unit. So you could have two principals on one stage working on one script, and then your second unit would have to have your third principal and really flog it hard rather than just doing the infills and the exterior shots. That's the only possible way you might do it with a single unit. I just can't understand otherwise what they were thinking.
The three leads does work because it's a bit different. If you go for one man and a woman, you're going to be accused of doing what the Avengers was already doing. I think having the three leads, it certainly makes it more flexible in terms of script writing, doesn't it?
That's the thing. The scripts are fairly well balanced. You don't get a feeling that something's been written in one respect and they've suddenly chopped and changed to integrate the three characters.
Yeah, and there aren't many episodes really where all three are not involved. I know that Alexandra's not in the Gilded Cage, for example, but for most of it, all three of them are there.
Yeah, I mean, even when you go on the holiday episodes, like you say, where somebody takes a few days off, they still insert one, if not two, pop-up scenes for that character just to keep the viewer reminded this is a three-handed game.
We've got a new television series for you, Call of Champions. It's exciting and intriguing, but don't take my word for it. Watch this channel soon and find out. My name's William Gaunt. I play Richard Barrett. One of the champions.
This is a point of contention. I happen to think, personally, that the main titles and the main titles music are probably the weakest of all the ITC productions. I think the opening titles don't give you anything as such. They're just standing in front of a blue screen with the fountain in the background. I mean, it's not like even in The Baron, you get a rough idea. They try to make the effort in the opening titles of this is an antiques dealer. He drives a fast car and he goes off jet setting around the world. And obviously in things like Randall and Hopkirk, you kind of get a mini premise. Department S, you get the same thing. And The Persuaders, you get their backstory. These are really quite bland, if we're being brutally honest. And I think the music as well, I mean, although it's very fondly remembered, it's not dynamic in the way that the Danger Man theme is or the Department S theme is. I know it's sort of that sort of sleazy jazz, but I don't think it kind of really suits what we're setting up here.
Yeah, it seems a little generic, the music, doesn't it? And the opening titles, as you say, there's a particular lack of dynamism in the titles. It could just be a fashion show, couldn't it? They're immaculately dressed. They get their little spots in front of the camera. But we have no real idea what on earth their role is going to be.
Well, the actors said, didn't they? Certainly William Gaunt said they had no clue what they were doing. They were just standing in front of a blue screen. They weren't told anything. And that comes over because, as you say, we don't, as viewers, have any idea. And when you consider this is coming on the back of The Prisoner and Man in a Suitcase, which in very different ways really do tell so much. They give you so much in the way of narrative. Here, they could be on holiday in Geneva, couldn't they? Why didn't Astley do the music? He's done the music on so many of these 60s ITC shows, and the incidental music will be mostly him and Albert Elms. Seems a strange choice to me.
Just seems a very odd choice to choose Tony Hatch. And what Tony Hatch then delivers, as in the sleazy jazz, is just a bit drab, really. I'm sure some people love it, and I'm sure some people think the titles are great. And my opinion is no better than anyone else's. It's just, for me, it feels a bit naff compared to all the other ITC shows. I'd like to talk about the structure of the episodes. We get the pre-title teaser, which is usually an intense bit of action. Someone's killed, or, you know, there's something going on like that. But then post-titles, we get the little introductory scenes where, you know, you get the David Bauer voiceover, and the champions themselves are doing things that are sort of quite fantastical, whether it's Richard and Craig throwing barbells across the gym to each other, or Sharon reading War and Peace in 20 seconds or whatever. I really like all those little sort of intro scenes. I think they're great fun, some of them. In a couple of the original scripts I've got, there was also going to be an additional introduction scene that was going to be filmed outside the Nemesis building, where each character in turn would walk towards the camera and David Bauer would give some extra voice over there. So he'd be say like, Craig Sterling is a champion. Sharon McGreedy is a champion, you know. So it's interesting that was scripted as well and not filmed, because that would have been shot on location. Going back to the little tag scenes, if you want to call them that, or the intro scenes, I thought they were great fun, and I wondered what you guys thought of them.
We do also obviously have something before those. We get the little Where in the World map, which I quite like. And once you're halfway through the series, you're thinking, please not Holy Lock. I think that Where in the World is rather fun. It sort of fits in again with this ITC and ITC heroes going across the world. It does annoy me that one or two of them crop up more than once.
As I was watching this run, I grew to love those little maps and the little inserts. They're sort of like the department esting, aren't they, for this series? There were far more of the little exposition vignettes than I remembered, because I remembered far more repeats probably than Rodney's thinking. There's a lot of variety in there. They're really quite entertaining.
Yeah, that world map, that was part of Tremaine's office, wasn't it? Which was actually an impressive set, and that was a revolving map. If there was something else, like they needed to watch a film, for example, they're in the ghost plane, they watch one where it spins around and you see it actually spinning around. And on the other side is a screen where they can watch the films. The only thing about those maps is the inconsistency of the maps, because occasionally you'll get one that's a completely different style of map. Things like that really bug me. That's just me being picky. But
there's the graphic designer talking.
We should probably talk about some episodes, and we have to obviously start with the beginning. There's a sort of an extra version of this episode where they filmed a bookend thing where the champions sort of have a tape recorder and reveal the secrets, and they leave it for Tremaine. And I believe that was filmed especially for Australia. So it could also be used anywhere else in the world. That could be inserted somewhere in the run as a repeat, and people would get the idea of why they've got these special powers, in case they've missed that episode at the start. As an episode, it's a bit stodgy. It seems to go on a bit, especially the bit once they're sort of being pursued by the Chinese foot soldiers. You know, they seem to be walking round and round and round in circles there. And there's a lot of padding. And I believe it was going to be a 90-minute introductory episode, which I think, seeing that now, if we'd had another 20, 25 minutes of stodging around in the snow, I think everyone would have fallen asleep.
I would have completely ditched the beginning. And what I would have done was to get over the concept of what's happened to them in the titles. Oh, I don't think it needed a whole episode to do that.
The first half of the beginning is great and the raid is great, but it does lose the plot partway through. That's one high-tech lamasery in the middle of Tibet. How on earth are they generating all that electricity to do all those funky lights? What I love is the fact that when they put them back into the plane after they've been fixed, they put them back in exactly the same position as they were in the crash.
I mean, there is a little bit of backstory there. I mean, you know, we find out that Sharon's a widow. It starts well, but then it sort of tails off.
Sharon is rather treated like a bit of a spare wheel. She's there because she has to be, because she's got the specialist knowledge. And Richard is quite sort of patronising, condescending to her. What we do find in the beginning, it sets the pattern for the series, because we have the brutal slaying of the Chinese guards. This becomes quite a series with a very high body count.
I was going to mention that, and I'm glad you did, the sort of violence in the series, because you're quite right. In a way, it sets the tone, doesn't it? That gunning down of the Chinese guards. And when you think about it, the violence at the time would have been asked to have been toned down for the American market in particular. You know, they were always worried about violence. So this is quite a violent series, considering it was going to be sold into the US.
But this is another beauty of the fact that it comes under fantasy. I think you get away with things that you wouldn't. To offer a comparison, Rod Serling knew that by creating a sci-fi show in Twilight Zone, he'd be able to tackle things he couldn't in a straightforward drama. And I think here, because we're thinking, oh, it's superpowers, I think somehow that camouflages the violence in a way that it doesn't in Danger Man. And they've got people using flick knives here.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the fantasy elements ameliorates the violence. A lot of the violence is in some of the most mundane situations, and some of it is quite nasty. But even the agents themselves, I mean, you're looking at like Richard, he's doing things like headbutts, which in this modern era have been excised from recent 007 movies.
But they got away with it. So there must be a reason they got away with it. My feeling is that it was less of an issue, violence in action adventure 60s stuff, than, for example, sexual content.
It's interesting how they did get away with it. When you sort of start counting it up and looking at some of the methods, we have strangulation, we have people being set on fire, and then you think this thing's going out, I think it's Wednesday night, 8 o'clock.
But I mean, Richard Barrett sticks his finger into an electric socket. Now, John Drake can't do that for obvious reasons, but because Barrett has superpowers, he can do it.
I think one of the best ones is To Trap a Rat, which I know is a fan favourite. I really like it because you get a lot of London in it. You get a lot of location work, you know, London Zoo. And that's another point. People seem to think that The Champions was one of these studio-bound series. But actually, when you watch it and watching it back, there's quite a lot of location work. It works well as a story. Ralph Smart clearly on the ball there. There is a rumour that this is a leftover Danger Man script. Now, we don't have any evidence whether it was or it wasn't, but you can imagine it working in a way for Danger Man. Obviously, it's been reworked to work for three leads as opposed to one. But I love the whole sort of swinging London, use of drugs. Sharon plays a critical role in it. I just thought it was nicely directed as well by Sam Wanamaker, and it ran over because he was taking his time and trying to get it to look really nice, which he does. And I just think if you would show someone who'd never seen an episode of the series to show them that, I think they'd be pretty impressed, really.
It's superb, isn't it? On every level. I love the fact, and this is obviously thanks to Ralph Smart, that this is an episode looking at the drugs chain in London. And so we get characters who appear, like Kate O'Mara, who's obviously a victim of the whole thing. And then she disappears. You know, someone who's working in a garage who's part of the chain appears and disappears. The peanut seller who's selling peanuts with drugs in them. And I love that idea. We really do get an idea of a chain where you meet this person once, that's it. Don't see them again. That disco teaser works really, really well, doesn't it?
You know why this is such a highly rated episode? Because it's Jazz's 1960s underbelly sleaze again with the disco and what have you. It starts really well. I love the way when the ambulance is travelling through the West End, how Monty's done his usual raid of his stock footage catalogue, and you've got different theatrical productions from different years varying between 1964 and 1967. But it really is a good episode. And it's such a pity that Sam Wanamaker got shot down for it and wasn't allowed to finish it.
He had taken 4 weeks, hadn't he? And you just can't take more than 10 days. You know, you've got 2 working weeks to do an episode. And I guess this is where you have to compromise. We all want the art, but you can't finish a series if everyone takes 4 weeks over it. Or am I being harsh?
To Sam Wanamaker's defence, I don't really remember him directing an episode of a 1-hour ITC series prior to this. And I think he probably thought, well, you know, they want it done in 10 days. I could do it in 10 days, but he wanted to craft it. He wanted to make it as great as it is. And even the use of the backlot in that episode is done well. And I think there's the difference, that he actually really sort of thought and composed the shots and thought about how everything is going to work. And okay, it would have cost money to go into London and film. Probably wasn't as straightforward as they were probably hoping it to be. But my God, the effect when you see all those scenes is brilliant. When they're looking up at Kate O'Mara's flat and they're all down on that busy London road and they all look immaculate as well. I must say that. And they just look the part. They really look really cool secret agents at that point. Come on, Rodney, let's hear one of yours.
The interrogation, which was obviously an atypical episode. I think they were struggling with budget. They wanted something made quickly, basically one main set. But I think this is an episode that does a number of things. First of all, it completely disproves Monty Berman's theory that he's running a factory. You can't expect art in a factory, which is what he says. This episode works brilliantly. It doesn't need a big budget, doesn't need a big cast. I mean, this is really a Colin Blakely, Stuart Damon doubleheader, isn't it? I just think it's spellbinding. I think it's a lot better, actually, than Colin Blakely's similar episode in Man in a Suitcase, Brainwash. I think he's just on crackling form here. And Stuart Damon, who at times is sort of playing the slightly wise cracking action man in this series, my goodness, he comes to the fore in this one. I've looked at some of the stills from when they were filming the scenes in his torture chamber, I think he calls it. And it pulls a completely different level of performance out of him. If this was an episode of The Prisoner, people would be talking about it for the next decade.
It is very much like an episode of The Prisoner, because there are these rumours, I don't know how true they are, that Dennis Spooner got to sit in some of the Prisoner pre-production meetings and picked up sort of vibes from that. But it's more like Department S, Small War of Nerves, when Peter Wingard was faced with Anthony Hopkins and he had to act. And that's what's happened here. Colin Blakely has come onto the set. Colin Blakely is one of the consummate actors of the period, be it small screen, stage, film. He's up there. He's in the top echelon. And it is really, really intense. It would work as a two-hand play. It's really well filmed. There's just that absolute pressure on there. And Damon has got to up his game to match Blakely. What really finishes the episode is the use of those fisheye lens shots.
There's actually one little sequence. Stuart Damon's character is sort of washing in a sink and suddenly he's gone underwater. And little bits like that, I just thought, fabulous. Not the sort of thing you'd expect in a conventional action-adventure series. And also some cracking dialogue. Colin Blakely says, "This room is your world. I'm your only visitor." Wow. My only problem, and again, this comes back to why I asked you, Jazz, earlier about so things like Writer's Bible, is that Tremaine is an absolute villain in this episode. He lies to everyone. He's happy to have one of his operatives basically being tortured. How can they go back to having a reasonable relationship with him next week? I mean, Sterling says to him towards the end, you know, what did you do? Get someone to drag me into your chamber of horrors. I think this would have made a great final episode, and it would have left the viewers thinking, my goodness, maybe Nemesis isn't this sort of quite cosy, everyone gets on place after all.
A Case of Lemmings. I think it's a brilliant little episode. You've got these dramatic opening scenes of these various suicides. You've got the little chess sequence for the exposition of the champion superpowers, which I think is very nice. As with any champions episode, you've got a lot of stock footage, but I think for the most part, they managed to integrate the stock footage fairly well. because they grade it up. So it's as bright as the film stock we're using, because the film stock we're using is, for my mind, quite overlit. We've got that nice little relationship here with Jeannie Rowland and William Gaunt. And then that's offset by the really nasty death of Jeannie Rowland's character throwing herself into the weir. It's a really good plot. It ends in a moral fashion, whereby the chief villain falls victim of his own formula. But I do think ITC villains ought to get some sense of style, because Edward Brayshaw, as Del Marco, the baddie, he's living on a flat on one of these crummy streets in the back lot.
Really uses drugs so powerfully. I mean, that scene where Sterling is going to fling himself off and become the latest lemming. And when he tries to describe to the others what the feeling is when you're under the influence, he says, you know, it's incredible. All you want to do is destroy yourself. It's like a sudden shock in the brain. And I thought that worked really, really well. It was really powerful.
Another thing about this one is Sharon gets a good crack of the whip again, and she's making the links. Like I said earlier, she's the sort of glue that binds the investigation together. But the other thing you notice about this, and you notice in general about the Champions, is there's so much overdubbing, which you would think a sort of money-minded person like Monty wouldn't go for.
There's plenty of examples of that. I mean, in The Dark Island, the Chinese general is dubbed. There was one that we were talking about pre to this, where I think it's the Gunrunners. He's not the Burmese captain, but there's someone that is in the ranks gets dubbed. And it's so obvious. The voices are so similar. I mean, I heard one and I thought, that's Gordon Tracy from Thunderbirds. It's a bit of a downer, really, when, you know, the rest of it is pretty good.
I like the fact that here, Sharon and Richard are pretending to be a couple and they have this sort of lover's tiff in the casino, because normally she's partnered with Stuart Damon if they're trying to do a sort of romantic pretend undercover thing. But picking up on what you said, Smudge, I thought the Rome stock footage and the back lot, they combine really well.
I do think it's a good episode. I struggle a little bit there with Edward Brayshaw. I suppose there's only really a couple more that we should mention in terms of being five-star crackers. And talking of cracker, I would say Nutcracker, which is almost like a mini Bond in a way. You've got that whole scene at the start of it where the agent is trying to work out how to get into this vault. And then you've got the whole thing with it sort of being a tie shop in the West End. And there's like a lift that goes down and all of this. I mean, it's such a great episode, brilliantly directed by Roy Ward-Baker. It's a cracking script, moves along at a really nice pace, no dragging in it. You know, and you wonder about the boss of MI5 or whatever it is. He's sort of all wrapped up in it. It's just a cracking episode.
It really does move well. And again, we get that thing, the brutality of the Champions, because David Langston as Lord Mornsey, he's strangled in his cell. And then his murderer is popped off by two fake policemen. The only sort of plot thing I would put up in this one is when Craig and Richard go to William Squire's house. Why isn't William Squire's safe alarmed?
They never were in ITC shows.
I love the fact you've got William Squire, who's head of M7. And of course, he's soon going to be head of the section in Callan. Just one of those lovely things about when you return to 60s and 70s shows all these years later and you see these people you're used to seeing in a particular part in another one.
And this one's got Roy Ward-Baker stamped all over it. It's one of the better directed episodes, the way his camera moves. And there's that lovely little long shot when Richard's coming out of the vault and you can just see in the far distance him reflected in that mirror.
And then there's one that we all agree on, isn't there? And this is a Brian Clements story, Auto Kill.
I think this is perfect ending.
Why? Because of the fight scene where it all begins to basically unravel itself.
At the end of it, literally, because you know there's been this non-competitive competition between the boys throughout the series, you know, the alpha male stuff we were talking about earlier, the closing lines of Craig and Richard. Craig says, "I got a lesson in equality." And Richard says, "Tell me about it later." It is quite poignant because it's the last episode and that you know there's going to be no later. They didn't come back for a second series.
I think it's got the single best piece of acting that we see in the entire series, and it doesn't even involve a word spoken. So after Craig Sterling has had to thump Richard Barrett twice, quite brutally, and my understanding is the two actors did all of that, that there were no people standing in on it. But when he's punched him twice, the camera just goes in on Stuart Damon and his eyes. He's really hurt. He's had to do this. And then he cradles him in his arms. And it's actually a properly moving piece of television drama. Pullman and Eddington are a great duo, aren't they? Because they hate each other. Paul Eddington's character is always saying, it's nothing to do with you being good at mind games. It's just a drug. You know, anyone could do this. And there's a real animosity between them.
They're really well-drawn characters because you know how brutal Barker is. And then Klein in Paul Eddington. Klein is a real sort of fop and a dandy, and he's quite the weakest link, isn't he?
Yeah, but also by this time of the series, we've got to know the characters of Craig and Richard. That whole fight scene, I mean, we care about them, don't we? If we're following the series, it's got a huge impact on the viewer.
The fake police station is brilliant because we've got all these extras coming in and out, making it seem like a busy police station. And in a touch that probably any Clemens could do, the one baddie henchman starts playing with the blue police light like he's like a little kid again. Yeah. And Eddington's character says, you know, come on, we've got work to do. And I just love little touches like that.
The other thing about this is Nemesis, like Department S, you never get that true impression that these are massive organizations. But actually in this one, you do see as they're walking through the corridors, some of the other operatives of Nemesis, which I thought was a nice closing touch as well.
Clunkers. And I think we're all in agreement with this one. From the high of To Trap a Rat by Ralph Smart, we then get the low from Ralph Smart in Get Me Out of Here, which is just banal, just seems to go nowhere, and it seems to take forever and ever. And there is some nice location footage, don't get me wrong. All of that stuff around the Nemesis building where Rich is being followed and stuff. Lovely, lovely location filming. It's just a nothing story. You wouldn't miss it. If you were watching a rerun of these episodes now, I wouldn't even bother looking at it. I mean, it's poor.
I think it's summed up by their excuse at the end when Tremaine wants to know how they were able to sort the problem out when it's pitch dark in the building. And they say that they eat lots of carrots.
You get an impression that not even the actors were particularly interested in the script. I find Desert Journey terminally boring. It's a very, very basic road movie. Script not particularly well done, trying to get that sort of fey decadence in with the party, that doesn't ring true to me either. A real non-story
waste of Jeremy Brett, really, isn't it? Brilliant actor like that. It's a plodder, isn't it? It's got the swinging party scene at the start. Sharon looks fantastic, but a bit like Happening, those desert sets within the studio, they just look so obvious. Some of the other sets in the studio, they get away with much, much better. But those desert sets just look pretty poor, to be honest.
This is the frustrating thing about the submarine sets, because we talked about this long before we thought about this podcast and how much we hated the back-to-back submarine stories. But actually, I do now quite have a fondness for that submarine set, because it's a really nice set.
Beautiful and brilliant, well-constructed set. And you get to see a great deal of it. I think it's in The Search. I made a note of it somewhere, which one it was. It's a fantastic set, and they must have spent a lot of money on it, and hence why it was reused. You're right. When we first mentioned this, I was the one who said, oh, God, ITC on boats, and I was dreading it and had poor memories of it, particularly the model work, I think. But actually, the set itself is stunning.
And then they go and blow it because they take you out up into the conning tower, which is really, really rubbish, and it's just a blue cyclorama in the background.
But Desert Journey, still, Desert Journey. I quite agree.
No, not clunker.
Can I offer an alternative clunker?
Please do.
Something that should have been a clunker, but actually I really like, and that is the Iron Man, because it is the Champions going semi-comic, and you would think, in theory, if you wrote down the plot for it, you'd say, oh, this is going to be terrible. And I thought George Marcel was absolutely brilliant as El Caudillo, this dictator who's now in exile, who's a Lothario. He's writing his memoirs, which are quite clearly all made up. There's some wonderful comic scenes between him and Bastido and between him and William Gaunt. William Gaunt, undercover as a sort of cook, has spent ages coming up with this elaborate dish, and Marcel's character just throws it straight in the bin. I thought the humour worked. And as a one-off, you wouldn't want an episode like that each week. But that was an episode I was not looking forward to. And actually, in the end, enjoyed.
Yeah, it should be a clunker. But there's one line that saves it, basically. I think it might be Cordio. He says something about the trio. They look like they come out of a comic opera. This episode is a comic opera.
Another witty, broadly script.
Yeah, yeah, but there's a lot of padding in there. I mean, the amount of times you see him doing the clay pigeon shooting, that gets a bit tedious.
It should be a clunker, but manages not to be.
Come on, let's have a pure clunker.
I think I'd probably go for something like Operation Deep Freeze. I struggle to actually write anything down about it. I mean, Richard Barrett and Craig Sterling are left to freeze in the cell. I'd have put the writer in there. The guest cast didn't seem to have any characters to draw upon. George Pastel lasted 12 seconds.
Essentially, it's just Jazzy's greatest nightmare. It's the other half of the beginning. It's another long ice chase plot, isn't it? The one thing that jumps out of it is the death of Hemming, again, getting to the champion's violence core. That's particularly brutal because he's strangled. Other than that, you've got a good bunch of villains. You've got Weimark, Peter Arn, Walter Gotell, and George Pastel. It pretty much wastes them.
Sharon's hardly in it. I'm not convinced by Patrick Weimark at all. There he is in The Power Game, superb actor, hamming it up in this.
And I think this is a series where the plots on the whole are really coherent. You watch Department S, and sometimes halfway through an episode, you're scratching your head. I'm not quite sure what's going on here. But on the whole, in The Champions, I think we've got really coherent, quite simple, but well-worked plots. And this one, I didn't really know what was going on.
That's our clunker selection. So if you are doing a rewatch, you might disagree with us. And you're always welcome to make some notes and pop them on the YouTube comments or whatever and say, you know, we disagree with you. The Champions did get an American network sale. It wasn't treated so well in the UK, though. It was held back by Thames until Colour Transmissions began, which I think was late 69 for them. Mm-hmm. So by the time it was seen in some regions, it was, you know, well and truly over. And the three stars had moved on to completely different things. I think it was very well received, to the point that there was a bit of merchandising going on with it. There was a comic strip in the Joe 90 comic. There were some gum cards and activities books.
It went out originally, and it's like Wednesday night at 9 o'clock. ATV Midlands obviously would treat it as a flagship show. Then we had Harlech, Granada, Yorkshire and Anglia. But most other stations were still pushing out on that slot repeats, continuing Avengers stories. And like you say, Thames didn't pick it up till late 69. But if you look through the schedules, they pick it up in November. Then after the end of the year, when you get into early 70, by which time this show is going to be pretty dated anyway, it seems to disappear.
Really think it dates? Because I think, unlike Strange Report, which does feel like it's the end of the 60s, I think superpowers people don't date.
The styles would date it, I think. It got a mixed reception. Some critics loved it, some critics hated it. And William Gaunt said the general feeling was a lot of people seemed to think it was so frightful and it really sort of stymied their careers.
But it didn't hinder Alexandra Bastido at all, because she became a big star because of it, especially in places like Spain, where they absolutely adored her and they knew her as La Bastido. And if you look, all of those sort of TV gossip mags of the sort of late 60s and 70s, Alexandra Bastido is a regular cover star and regularly interviewed in those Spanish magazines all the time. I've done a lot of research on that. And she would fly over and do films in Spain because she could speak Spanish. So it didn't hinder her really at all. And then, you know, she did the BBC series Codenames. She did the Aphrodite Inheritance. I think William Gaunt maybe got hindered by it, but I don't think Alexandra did at all.
She said, yes, she did the Aphrodite, but she never got the sort of Champions exposure again. She found it quite scary. Instant fame, you know, suddenly you're walking down the street and everybody knows you and asking for you.
Well, let's be honest, she was so badly stalked, she ended up buying a couple of Dobermans. I think it was very, very difficult for young, extremely attractive actresses in the 60s. I think you got an awful lot of attraction that you didn't want.
In his memoir, Cyril Frankel says, out of all the stuff he did, his favourite series remains to this day The Champions, the concept and the beauty of our star, Alexandra Bastido.
I mean, in terms of the critical response, all I would say is that it's very easy to knock escapist action adventure, and TV critics often do. They don't like TV series and like one-off dramas. I think there's an awful lot of snobbery. The bottom line is, all three of us have watched this series again recently, more than 50 years after it was made, and I was entertained, weren't you?
It was strange rewatching them because I thought I must have watched them a lot when they were repeated in the 80s, because I remember I recorded them. I must have watched them so many times because they all felt so familiar. There was only a couple that I was thinking like, oh yeah, I've kind of forgotten a bit here. And that was a genuine mix up really with the submarine stories. I was trying to work out which one was which. I think on the most part, it holds up pretty well.
I think I got more out of them than I was expecting, because again, I thought I was going to suffer from over-familiarity. The only one I felt really overexposed to was The Invisible Man. I seem to have watched that hundreds of times. That didn't really move me in any sense on this show, but for the rest of them, yes, I have been entertained.
But that was the one that was remastered for Blu-ray and looks stunning in Blu-ray. You know, I watched that sort of three or four times on Blu-ray when it first appeared. A couple of things we haven't mentioned is the sort of reuse of sets, particularly that L-shaped staircase and grand interior of a house. The red flock and the green flock wallpaper seem to be in every episode. I think critics might have picked up on, fair enough. And that's Monty pushing it to do his 30 episodes, where I think he could have probably lost a couple here and there and done 28 or 26 and spread the budget a little bit more. Every one I was watching, I was thinking like that set was in the last one.
I think you notice it more in The Champions, particularly as you say, the staircase and the hall. At the end of the day, it's part of the charm, isn't it?
I didn't notice any terrible stunt doubles.
This is a series where if the champions, as in the characters, were needed on location, they did go actually to the location, and you didn't see any stunt doubles as such. Unlike, say, in Randall or Department S, where the double for Mike Pratt is terrible and the double for Ken Cope is equally as terrible, you know.
Wingard.
Well, exactly.
The only one that jumped out at me, can't remember the episode title, where they were defusing the bomb. When
Final Countdown.
Craig and Richard burst through the glass. That very good stunt, as they do the rollover and recover, the bad stunt double for Stuart Damon really stuck out, but that's the only one I can think of.
As we have waxed lyrical about Alexandra, we should probably talk about her costumes a bit. I thought her costumes were wonderful, really. And whatever she wears, she looks fantastic in, doesn't she? And I love those very 60s coats that she wears in a couple of episodes. There's one that's a sort of tan colour with red U-shaped pockets. And then she's got a sort of purple one with yellow. So 60s and so mod. I mean, she looks great no matter what she wears.
Well, there's that black check coat she wears in Regent's Park Zoo. And she looks fabulous.
When she comes in late to the meeting to Tremaine's and she's wearing that shimmery thing, you know, and she says, sorry, I got held up. And then you get a semi-patronising line from Craig saying, dress like that, I'm not surprised. She did say that the problem was they would only budget from episode to episode for the wardrobe. They didn't take a stock. So on her occasional free days, she was always being dragged around the shops by the wardrobe mistress trying to find outfits for the next episode.
In contrast to Alexandra, though, Stuart Damon always seems to be wearing that yellow roll neck later in the run.
Like the guys say, they end up in standard shiny suits.
It struck me that in Autokill, at one point, one of the villains says to a nemesis agent, well, you guys all speak five or six languages, you know, you've got to in your job. And you've got an actress who spoke five languages fluently. She went on to work for a while for the Home Office. She worked at Number 10 translating. I think she worked on Miss World translating. And yet they don't use that at all. And I thought that they missed a trick there, because we often get really bad foreign accents, et cetera, on ITC shows or any action adventure. And here you've got a genuine linguist and they could have used that skill.
Well, it would have added something more to her character as well, wouldn't it? It's another string to her bow that is kind of missing, really. If we're going to look at things in general, I think The Champions is a pretty decent ITC series. Yes, it has its flaws, and of course it has its clunkers, like all ITC series do. But I think the three work really well together. And I think there's a lot of shared screen time that makes it work, so they don't feel disjointed like some of the other ITC shows do, where there's three leads. The stories are pretty much grounded, and you know, you can believe that they're like what would have been going on in the Cold War. There is a bit of fantastical stuff going on with ex-Nazis down the mines and things like that. But yeah, I can overlook those. Overall, I think as a series that I'm very familiar with, it was lovely to come back and rewatch them all.
I was obviously coming new to the show. I'd seen the beginning once or twice, but I hadn't seen it as a series. Thoroughly entertaining. There were probably only 3 out of the 30 episodes that I wouldn't want to watch again. And I think it comes over on screen how well all three of them got on. You could see it. It adds chemistry to the characters.
I've really enjoyed coming back to it again. Like Jazz, I thought I was going to be over familiar with it. It's still worth a spin. I mean, it's not world shattering in terms of script. There's no great thematic depth, but it's not meant to be. It's just meant to be a bit of fun. And if you take it as that, that's what it'll give you.
I'd like to say thanks for listening. Thanks especially to Mark Rogers, like I said earlier, for sharing some very important and interesting information that we were unaware of. I really appreciate that, Mark. So thank you. And thanks obviously to my co-hosts, as always, Rodney Marshall out there in the wilds of Suffolk and Al Smudge there in Wolverhampton.
Cheers, Jazz. It's been great to discuss and always good to get back together.
Yep, lovely. Thank you very much, Jazz.
So we'll be back somewhere in the future when we decide what we're going to talk about next. We haven't done that. We don't plan too far in advance. And as always, it's a pleasure to be able to do this ITC Entertain the World podcast for you. See you again soon. You have been listening to the ITC Entertain the World podcast with Jazz Wiseman, Rodney Marshall, and Al Smudge. It was a Bitter and Twisted production for The Morning After.